Well, we are ready to proceed this morning. The first case is Feinberg versus the Department of Revenue or the Commissioner of Revenue. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Back in the good old days, when I started practicing, they'd call it the service, and then it became this and that. Now it's the Commissioner.
Yes.
So here we are.
Are you ready? May it please the court. This court held in the Alpenglow case that the IRS can administratively determine that the taxpayer, quote, committed the crime of trafficking in a controlled substance in violation of the CSA, unquote, in order to apply Section 280E. The IRS has made a like determination here. The burden in this proceeding required the taxpayer to disprove the crime.
The tax court just kind of declined to deal with the 280.
It has declined.
Skipped, right?
Well, it skipped the resolution of it. But the burden of proof, the court did make clear that the burden of proof was on the taxpayer. And that's why we brought this up. It's kind of difficult in this case because since she declined to issue rulings on so much of the case, we chose to address only those that she addressed, and part of it was the burden of proof within there.
But she's correct, isn't she? I mean, the burden of proof is on the taxpayer.
Burden of proof is on the taxpayer. As the court found in Alpenglow, the burden of proof is on the taxpayer.
But and in this case, in the prior opinion.
In the prior opinion, yes. And what we're saying on this, and what we said in Alpenglow, is that if the burden was placed on the taxpayer to disprove the crime, that it would make the statute constitutionally infirm. That was not in front of the court in Alpenglow. It's front and center here. That putting the
Boy, I don't remember Alpenglow saying that. I'm pretty familiar with Alpenglow.
I know you wrote the decision. But with respect to this, what we're saying here is that placing the burden of proof on the taxpayer to disprove the crime, it makes the 280E constitutionally infirm. Now, I know in the Alpenglow case,
the burden of proof wasn't on the taxpayer to disprove the crime. It was just on the taxpayer to show that they weren't trafficking. They had to show that they weren't, essentially.
Well, and that is the question. What is the burden of proof? And the burden of proof is really a two-step analysis here. There are two levels. First, as the government mentions in page 29 of their brief, that the taxpayer must bring itself inside the statute to demonstrate the entitlement to the deduction, which the taxpayer has in this case. The parties did not agree that the taxpayer substantiated most of the deductions. And so that's the first step. The second step is the taxpayer needs to place themselves outside of Section 280E. The commissioner makes an administrative determination that they are a drug trafficker. So now they have to prove that they are not a drug trafficker, proving the negative. And proving the negative is generally an impossible task.
Well, I don't know. I mean, if they came in and said, you know, we sell greeting cards, and they brought in evidence to prove that, I don't see how that's all that difficult.
But as they show in Spicer v. Randall, the problem is that it's not only selling greeting cards, but that is selling greeting cards to the exclusion of selling marijuana.
Well, they did, the commissioner did allow some of the cost of goods deduction, right?
Only from the standpoint that prior to the court proceedings, the taxpayers were unaware that the auditor was investigating the illegal conduct. And there was discussion. There was
acting as if they were somehow a law enforcement agency instead of a tax collector.
So
I have some sympathy with you on that point.
Mm-hmm.
But that's not my question. My mm-hmm. question didn't they allow some of the cost of goods allowance?
Only with the information
well,
that was received.
Well, if the answer is only,
yes.
Then they allowed some.
They allowed some.
So the answer is yes, they did allow some.
Some cost of goods sold, but
now how did they make that determination as to what portion they would allow? That's
That was an issue that we were not allowed to get into on trial. We tried to get in back of the determination. The court would not allow us to go there.
All right, thank you.
You haven't appealed that, have you? You haven't appealed that either, have you?
With regard to
the cost of goods sold determination, any aspect of that?
Well, we did the burden of proof. Now, with regard to the substantiation part, that was agreed to by the parties, and we said the court, by ignoring the substantiation, sui sponte, that was error. With respect to the...
Even if it was error, and you're talking now about 162A whether these were ordinary and necessary business expenses.
Right.
But that doesn't answer the question that ultimately I think you have to get to, which is whether under 280E they met their burden. Even if you did stipulate, and I didn't see a stipulation in the record anywhere, you weren't stipulating to 280E and your burden under that.
Right, exactly. We were stipulating as to the burden under 162, effectively. That's what it was. And if you look at the court order says, with regard to the remainder of the expenses, does 280E apply? Then she backs up and says, well, since they didn't substantiate, which was not an issue in the case, I'm not going to address 280E. That's where we consider that was the error. And she should have considered section 280E. But with respect to the 280E, and this is where we get into the burden of proof issue, what is the burden of proof to disprove that you are a drug trafficker? And the burden was placed on the taxpayer to prove that they were not a drug trafficker.
But that, you know, you argue that somehow violates the Fifth Amendment. A burden of proof that requires you to show that you're not committing a crime doesn't implicate the Fifth Amendment, and isn't that what the Supreme Court said in United States versus Rylander?
I'm going by Spicer versus Randall, which did say that the presumption that the government may not place a presumption of guilt on even in a civil tax setting, that you can't put a presumption of guilt on the taxpayer. And that's and we think that Spicer v. Randall is controlling.
Spicer isn't even a Fifth Amendment case, is it?
It is First not Amendment. Fifth Amendment per se. It is due process with presumption of innocence, and it dealt with the issue of having to profess innocence of the crime. It's effectively our argument. They couched it in due process, but Spicer v. Randall is effectively our argument. That we have to profess, we have to openly state that we either did not commit the crime or we committed the crime in part and did not commit the crime in part, and with regard to the cost of goods sold, that we have to disclose the nature and the extent of the crime. That was our burden of proof here. And the problem is that we, as a taxpayer, have to declare our innocence or deny that we committed the crime. And so what is the burden of proof on 280E? It is the unlawfulness of the activity.
Let's cut to the chase on the Fifth Amendment. The argument here is that the statute of limitations is going to preclude any charge against you anyway, and therefore it's a non-issue for us.
Well, it certainly wasn't a non-issue during the pendency of the proceeding. The statute of limitation was alive. The government reserved all rights to prosecute based upon the information provided. That was the one letter that we confirmed.
What do you mean to prosecute?
They reserved all rights to prosecute under federal criminal drug laws for any information. They didn't say that they would. They were reserving the right.
Is this a tax case or a criminal case?
What we did, and I can get you the exact site in the appendix. It's in our reply brief, that we asked for immunity from prosecution. You said that we're violating federal criminal drug laws. We want immunity of prosecution so we could provide documents. This was post-Feinberg 1.
Okay.
And they said, no grant of immunity. We're fully reserving the right to prosecute based upon anything that you present in this tax proceeding. So that's what we were faced with.
So they made this a quasi-criminal case at that point, basically.
Exactly. And so now we're faced with the possibility of prosecution if we presented evidence with respect to the unlawful trafficking. So that put the Feinbergs and McDonald in a, I think the court calls it, between a rock and the whirlpool.
Those cases are very different. The Leary case and the Marchetti case, and those are cases where you violate one criminal statute by not admitting that you're violating another criminal statute. Here, the only issue is whether you qualify for these deductions. And so it's just a question of whether you pay the full tax or you get to take advantage of a deduction that's not available to you if you're selling a controlled substance.
And that's the same situation that was sitting in Spicer v. Randall.
I don't know how you rely on that case that isn't even Fifth Amendment and totally ignore United States versus Rylander, that very clearly says shifting the burden of proof does not violate the Fifth Amendment. The fact that you have the burden to come in and prove that you're entitled to a 280E exemption cannot violate the Fifth Amendment because you're not being asked to come in and say, I'm trafficking in a controlled substance. Your burden is to say, I'm not.
Well, and you're not being compelled. You're not being compelled. There's no compulsion. A failure of proof, Rylander says, isn't compulsion to prove.
But this, well, we have to look at the nature of the proceeding here. This is not private litigants going to battle. This is the government in an administrative proceeding making an allegation that there's unlawful trafficking. This civil proceeding is not a general, it is part of the due process rights. And this is a continuation of the administrative process. This is not a question of a plaintiff there. And so from that standpoint, we start getting into the issue. We have, in order to get the deductions and our constitutionally mandated cost of goods sold, we have to either profess the innocence or admit the guilt. And there is no immunity because
well, you
government
don't have to admit the guilt. You either have to profess the innocence and qualify for the exemption or remain silent and pay the full tax.
Pay tax on gross receipts in the discretion of the government. This court ruled that cost of goods sold is constitutionally mandated. They can bypass the constitutional mandate by forcing the taxpayer to remain silent.
You did not appeal cost of goods sold. You appealed 280E and the shifting of the burden of proof with regard to your obligation to qualify for that exemption. So I don't know why we're even talking about cost of goods sold.
We don't think that the burden of proof was so limited to a particular deduction or an exemption. And with that, I'm going to reserve my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Good morning, and may it please the court. I'm Francesca Ugolini, counsel for the Commissioner of Internal Revenue. We agree with the taxpayers that the tax court...
Ms. Ugolini, these cases are frustrating because under the Constitution, under the 10th Amendment, of course, the powers of the federal government are limited to the powers granted under the Constitution, and the states reserve certain powers. And what we have here, basically, is a huge federalism dispute. Colorado says it is legal to grow and sell marijuana. The federal government says marijuana is a controlled substance. Now, your role in the tax business is not to go around prosecuting people or not prosecuting people. Your job is to raise taxes. And normally, in the ordinary course of business, you allow a business that is legal to deduct against their gross sales all expenses, either the cost of goods sold or the cost of production, etc. So the IRS says, in this case, even though the business is legal in Colorado, because the federal government says it is not legal, to sell marijuana or, quote, traffic in marijuana, you're going to have to pay taxes on the whole bloody thing. No cost of goods sold, no cost of production. Colorado, you up yours. We're going to ignore anything that you as a state under the United States Constitution have the power to do and has done. So it's your interest here to raise taxes. What you're saying is, okay, we're not only going to raise taxes, we are going to punish this business to the point of destruction. And you get into this huge mix of tax raising and criminal law. Now, these taxpayers come and say, well, if you will kindly give us protection, we'll give you any record you want, but we don't want to give you records that, that the federal government can turn around and prosecute. So you, as I understand it, you send auditors out to make, for what, I don't know for what purpose. What are you trying to prove? That they're selling marijuana? They're admitting they're selling marijuana. They're admitting they're growing marijuana. They're saying that's all legal under the power of the state of Colorado to so declare. But what you're trying to do, it seems to me, with all due respect, is not just raise ordinary and necessary taxes. What you're trying to do is take this company or any company, forget this company, forget the, just look at the entire industry and say, we're going to tax 100% of gross sales, no exemptions whatsoever for the cost of goods, or the deductions that would ordinarily and normally granted any business that is legally operating within their state. And that seems to be more a power to destroy. So what I'm looking at is this. First of all, has any court declared the constitutionality of 280E in the context of whether it is constitutional to deprive the cost of goods sold or the cost of production when a taxpayer is paying their taxes purely for tax purposes? If you'd address that, please. The cases that have so ruled.
I can. And in the context of answering your question, though, yes, with all due respect, I want to correct, I think, what might be a misunderstanding on your part about how 280...
I'm just
sure
to this case, sure, unlike my colleagues who apparently have been involved not only in analyzing them, but in writing the decisions of the cases.
Sure. First of all, this court in the Alpenglow case addressed the argument that it was unconstitutional to tax gross income without allowing the deductions for the business expenses, and this court rejected that argument. I believe the Ninth Circuit in the Olive case also addressed the constitutionality of 280E. There's been many of 280E specifically, and held that it was constitutional. But what I'd like to correct, there's a difference between allowing a reduction for cost of goods sold and allowing deductions for business expenses, and it's sort of nuanced. But the federal tax law 280E does not result in a marijuana business being taxed on its gross receipts. The reduction from gross receipts for cost of goods sold is recognized by the IRS in the legislative history of 280E. Congress acknowledged that it was not trying to tax gross receipts and that these businesses would be allowed a reduction for cost of goods sold. And in this particular case, the IRS gave them that adjustment, and in fact, ended up when the audit was underway.
May I ask on that point?
Sure.
If you'd hold that thought, on what basis was the apportionment made as to what would be allowed on cost of goods and what would not, and what would be disallowed?
Usually, the costs that are allowed for cost of goods sold usually are the direct costs of inventory. So if the company is buying marijuana from a wholesaler, it would be the cost of buying it. Here, THC was also a grower, a cultivator of marijuana. So some of the costs that the IRS agent allowed were wages for the employees. She observed, actually during the audit, there was never any assertion of Fifth Amendment rights, and THC invited the IRS in to observe its operations and look at its books and records. And this all came out at the tax court trial. The IRS agent testified that she observed the employees at work. She saw that when they weren't working with customers, they were attending to the plants. And she made an estimate of how much of their time was spent on the cultivation side versus the sales side. And I think she came up with, it was maybe a 40% split. And she ended up reclassifying many of the expenses that that THC had claimed as deductions. She reclassified those as cost of goods sold and ultimately ended up giving THC the benefit of cost of goods sold that was $140,000 greater than what THC had even claimed on its tax returns. So the IRS actually bumped up cost of goods sold from what THC originally claimed. The only cost of goods sold that were not allowed were items where there was no explanation. It was just a dollar amount on the books and records that the IRS agent had seen, and there was no explanation for those items. And so she said, well, if you can substantiate them, you know, we'll give them to you, but there was no substantiation. And that was a small amount of things that was disallowed. So we don't have a situation where THC is subject to tax on their gross receipts from sales. They did get a substantial adjustment for cost of goods sold, and that is required under the tax law. As to the remainder of your question about the propriety of 280E, I think you express a view that many taxpayers have expressed. There are other members of Congress who have introduced bills to limit the effect of 280E on state-licensed marijuana businesses, recognizing that there are these federalism issues. So far, none of those bills have advanced to change the law. And at the end of the day, the law is what it is. Congress makes the federal tax laws. 280E applies across the board to any business that involves, that consists of the trafficking in controlled substances, whether it's legal under state.
Have you taken a position on those congressional bills, or have you had occasion to do so?
I don't know if the Department of Treasury has. The Department of Justice doesn't get involved in those types of things. We enforce the laws that exist. And this law has been on the books, I believe, since the 80s. So the businesses in Colorado and California and some of these other states that, you know, have decided to go into this business are or at least should be fully aware of the tax implications of deciding to enter that type of business.
Given that your interest is in raising taxes and not that is the tax folks' business is in raising taxes, why don't you just grant immunity to these businesses and allow them to fully report all this information without fear of being prosecuted?
I was not involved in the proceedings in the tax court. I know that was a discussion between the IRS litigated this case in the tax court, and I know that was some kind of conversation between the IRS trial attorney and I believe the U.S. Attorney's Office in Colorado in terms of an agreement as to immunity. And I can't give you a reason why immunity wasn't granted in this case. My understanding is that immunity is not routinely granted, but at the same time, I'm not aware of a single case in which the federal government has used information that it obtained in a civil tax case to then turn around and prosecute one of these companies.
Well, that's the terrible position that the industry appears to be in from my reading of the briefs, is that the Department of Justice has taken a position, well, we're not going to prosecute. And so the business is ongoing. The industry in Colorado and I suppose other states is ongoing. And they're not being prosecuted. But on the other hand, the threat of prosecution is like a hammer over their head whenever it comes time to pay the taxes. And it just seems to me that the Department of Justice at some point ought to make a decision to either fish or cut bait on the issue, and if they're going to prosecute, then prosecute and bring the whole thing to a head. Or grant immunity and allow the tax operations to operate somewhat more smoothly than they're operating. That's just one perspective.
I understand. I mean, there is an alternative for a taxpayer such as THC. I mean, as I mentioned, the law is 280E is pretty clear. It has been on the books for a long time. So as a company that, you know, is knowingly breaking federal law, so to speak, when preparing their tax return, I mean, they should have known that they were not allowed to take the business expense deductions and that by doing so, they're inviting an IRS audit.
No, I understand, but that's the dilemma, that if that it's either they do or they don't.
Right.
If they don't, then they're in a bit of a pickle, aren't they?
It is a dilemma, and the Supreme Court acknowledged that in the Rylander case, that in a civil case where a party decides to invoke the Fifth Amendment, they are free to do so, but they have a hard choice to make because they do have to bear the consequences of the lack of evidence. And this court made the same statement in an opinion actually authored by you, Judge Lucero, a civil forfeiture case,
right.
United States versus $148,840. And it is a difficult choice.
Right.
But as I said here, in this case, the IRS did sort of bend over backwards to give the taxpayer that upwards adjustment on cost of goods sold and acted within the law in denying the business expense deductions.
You do agree, though, if I'm reading your brief and hearing your position correctly, that the tax court erred in requiring them to substantiate their business expenses, because that apparently was the subject of the stipulation that we don't have.
That's right. And in the tax court, the commissioner had filed a response to the taxpayer's motion for reconsideration, agreeing that lack of substantiation had never been raised. I think it's maybe fair, you know, in the tax court's defense, I think that she may have been using the word substantiation. In the tax world, we usually think of that as show us your receipts. I think she might have been using that interchangeably with proof. And so it's
maybe she was referring to 280E.
In her order
to the lack of proof.
I think that it's fair to read her opinion that way because I think she says it most clearly in her order denying reconsideration. The tax court characterizes its own prior opinion as holding that the petitioners failed to carry their burden of proving that the IRS's notice of deficiency was incorrect. So I think overall, it's fair to characterize her opinion ultimately as one holding that the taxpayers failed to carry their burden of proof.
But she expressly says, I'm not going to reach the 280E issue. So I think it's kind of hard to massage her opinion into a ruling on 280E when she expressly said, I'm not reaching that.
I think that's right. We agree she should have reached 280E. At the end of the day, though, I guess in this case, the posture is sort of strange because there was never really a factual dispute about 280E. The taxpayers really had just made legal arguments about 280E. And now here we are on appeal where those have boiled down to the sort of interaction between 280E and the burden of proof, which really are just legal arguments that we believe this court can address. If the court has no further questions, we just ask that you affirm the decision of the tax court.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Your Honor, what you were talking about and the problem that the industry faces is demonstrated in this case. The tax court found that the Feinbergs and McDonald's received no compensation, period, in this, but yet have a $300,000 tax on no compensation. This is the way the phantom income is being created under Section 280E. And this is the problem that we're facing. They have to come forward and give a burden proof that we're not a drug trafficker. And the caption of 280E says, expenditures in connection with the illegal sale of drugs. One of the things they said is, well, all you have to do is show trafficking. Trafficking without the illegality brings in the entire healthcare system of the United
States.
But
it is illegal. It's illegal under federal law, and that's the problem. This is, as Judge Lucero said, and some of our opinions have said, this is a huge conflict between how the federal government treats marijuana and how some of the states treat marijuana. And so long as we have a supremacy clause, your clients are going to lose because it's still illegal under federal law.
Well, it's not completely illegal, and that's the thing. And that's
illegal under federal law?
Well, like University of Georgia. For example, University of Georgia, if you take that, it's always illegal. University of Georgia, with its research program, is a drug trafficker because they are trafficking marijuana. But it's not. The big part of showing it's not whether or not the substance is listed on Schedule 1 or Schedule 2. It is the illegality. The illegality has to be demonstrated. You say, oh, it's obvious in this case, but it still doesn't change the burden of proof, that the taxpayer has to prove that they did not commit the crime. And that's the burden. Whether you think it's obvious or not, a criminal that the commission of the crime could be obvious, but that does not negate the fact that there are burdens of proof that have to be proved to show that they committed the crime. And with that,
all the other states that have legalized the growth and sale of marijuana, are they all being treated in the same manner for tax purposes, for federal tax purposes?
To my knowledge, and with the decisions that have been coming out of Colorado, they have been becoming much more aggressive with cost of goods sold. We do have several cases where they have provided no cost of goods sold at all, and putting the taxpayer in the position of having to demonstrate the nature and extent of their crime in order to get cost of goods sold and not be taxed on gross receipts. Unless the court has any other questions.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
Thanks a lot.